Hi everyone, I'm Joanna, and this is Hyphenated, the podcast about living in the hyphen. Jenny's not here today, but I am accompanied by a very good friend of mine. He's a TV writer, a comedian, and you know what? I'm not going to continue this introduction because I don't want to give anything away, even though the title of the episode probably gives a lot away. But Alex Estrada, my friend, my coworker, can't believe you're here on the podcast.
I know. It's crazy. Thank you for publicly coming out as my friend. That's, I feel like that's, you know, a bad move for you career-wise, but...
It's crazy. We work together every single day. You're the head writer now. I used to be head writer of Hamster and Gretel. You're now the head writer. I'm now something else that I don't fully understand.
We like to say around the office that you've gone to a better place.
I've gone to a better place. Yeah. And weirdly, it's not better. It's not better.
It's the same place you've been for the last 3 years. It's crazy. Yes.
But me and you met, what is it like, 12 years ago?
Or? I think it was 11 years ago. Mm-hmm. As I recall the story, you and I were both placed on house teams at the People's Improv Theater, New York City. Mm-hmm. Which is sort of a very gracious way of saying that, because we were barely teams.
we were basically just paying to perform in New York. That's right. Kind of what it was. I always thought you were really, really funny and a very good writer. And then when I started at Flama, I was like, this guy's a good writer. Why don't we have him write a video? And then you wrote a video that went super viral.
It did.
Was it Calexicans? Oh, no, it was. If 4th of July was treated like Cinco de Mayo.
That's right, right, right. If Mexicans celebrated the 4th of July like Americans celebrate the Cinco de Mayo, was the video. I remember that day very well because, I remember getting those messages from you that's like, oh, it's breaking our platform. This is when you could still get people to watch videos on Facebook. And it was just like this crazy thing. It's the most press that anything I've ever done has received, and still seven 8 years on. So it's very, very sad. Yes,
it ultimately ended up being the peak of your life. Your opus.
That's true.
Five minute video.
That's right. The most profitable piece of content I ever made, and I was paid, I think, $200 for it.
But look at us.
Exciting. Look at us now.
And now we're making cartoons at Disney.
That's right.
And getting paid approximately $200, which is amazing.
For the work we do. Yes.
So a couple of years ago, I guess it was years, right? Mm-hmm. We were hanging out, and me and you, we have a very jokey friendship. Even when we venture and speak about, you know, our mental health or how we're doing, it's always tinged in humor, I feel. Like even when we're being truthful, it always has to end with a joke. So
yes.
You know, so that's sort of, I think, where a lot of why we collaborate so well writing together, where it comes from. But a couple years ago, we were talking in my office in Bushwick, and you had mentioned, you had made a joke, as you do, that you were an orphan, that both your parents were dead. They had passed in your 20s. And I remember very vividly you making a like passing remark about your dad and how you think that maybe, or you thought at the point that maybe your dad was involved in a murder. And I remember laughing because I thought you were kidding. And I was like, you freaking weirdo. And you were like, I wish I was joking. So, you know, from then on, you've sort of taken basically this question in your life that I'd like you to explain to our audience a little bit more, but you've taken this question in your life and have tried to find an answer to it, right?
Right. Yeah. So, and just sort of, you know, catching, everyone up. So the way the story goes is that when I was a kid and growing up, we used to get these, phone calls, to my house. We get this call that was like, this is a collect call from Calvin Jones, who is an inmate at a California correctional facility. You know, you get those little robot call things there. And my my dad would always accept these calls, which was weird because, you know, my dad was a super cheap guy and like would never accept any of our calls collect. This is back when people still use payphones, but he always took the calls from this dude. And this was just sort of like part of our lives growing up, that when Calvin called, you would take the phone to dad and, you know, dad would talk to him. And if he wasn't home, then you would just sort of hang up. And it wasn't until I was a teenager in high school that I sort of was like, yeah, who the hell is this guy who keeps calling our house? And so at that point, I discovered or found out or was told that basically Calvin had been my dad's best friend, and that before I was born, before my siblings were born, dad and Calvin had been put on trial for the murder of their business partner back in the 1970s. And that was just kind of like a little piece of my childhood.
Just like a fun little fact, like, oh yeah, I had a swing set, oh, my parents moved around a lot, and my dad was put on a murder trial in the 70s.
We have an above ground pool, and yeah, my dad's a very dangerous person. And the thing is, you know, my dad sort of told me this kind of story at the time, you know, that they'd sort of both been set up in a way that it was a politically motivated prosecution and the police were incompetent. And ultimately, the case was dropped against my dad, but Calvin was convicted of this murder. And the entire, you know, since before I was born and my entire childhood up until my 20s, like, you know, that was the thing. Calvin was in jail and he would call and talk to my dad all the time. And so for many years, we've had this discussion, my siblings and I, more since he passed away. It was always this thing of like, oh, do we think dad actually had something to do with it? Because it was kind of weird that he was so close with Calvin, they were best friends, and that Calvin would go away for murdering this guy and dad wouldn't. Mm-hmm. And so it was always this question of like, all right, so is Calvin really innocent and dad was telling the truth, or is dad really guilty? And, you know, and feels bad that Calvin's in jail. And, you know, our discussion about it eventually led to me sort of trying to find the answer for myself. And the result is a podcast series called The Estate, which is available on Apple, Spotify, wherever. If you're listening to this podcast right now, that hyphenated, you can go in that search bar. You can stop this episode right now. Find and download The Estate and listen to the entire thing online. That's right. I am promoting my podcast in the middle of your podcast and encouraging people to stop listening and go over there right now. Get out of this. Best
absolute
you can.
Absolute shameless plug. But you know what? At least it's an honest plug. Let's be honest.
Yes, of course.
You know?
Of course.
Well, I mean, because so a lot of people have like secrets in their families, secrets in their lives, stuff that you sort of keep in the family closet, as it were. But you decided to air this out publicly on a podcast, right? So because here, let me explain something to you.
Sure.
I am an enormous true crime fan. Like, I don't think a lot of my listeners know this about me, but it is truly the way that I relax. And it's not because I'm a psychopath. It's because I like finding order in chaos. I like listening to stories of like deep human depravity and then finding order in it, finding that like there's a justice system and there's witnesses and there's this and there's that. And then there's at the end of the day, you catch the right person that did it, right? And I always felt a little bit, I would say, guilty about it. I don't, you know, so many of these true crime podcasts that are hosted by, like, it's always hosted by, like, two white women that are like, and today we're going to solve the murder of Janky Jenkins. But right now, a word from our sponsors. Do you want 15% off Squarespace? Like, it all feels so, like, weird, right? Like, it feels like we are using entertainment, we're using trauma as entertainment. And
right.
I always felt weird about it, but I do find it like incredibly interesting. And so you're a very good friend of mine that is on the other end of this. You're creating the podcast, but in such a different way, because a lot of the people that host these podcasts have nothing to do with a crime. Or even if they do have something to do with a crime, it's like, I went to high school with the murderer, you know? And it's like, you probably didn't even talk to them in high school. Let's be real. You're using this as a platform again. But you are inextricably linked to this. This is your dad, And so how was the process of you deciding to do this, first of all? And what was the process like? Did you find more closure? Did you find more peace? Or just walk us through how crazy this has been.
Right, right. So, like I said, I think I have that sort of same understanding of wanting to create order out of chaos. The messiness and the sort of the weeds of people's lives are sort of entertaining and very fascinating. And I think for me and for my siblings as well, that was sort of the initial draw into trying to find out more about this case. Like, part of it, I think, is our dad was sort of very mysterious. He was always sort of, when he talked about that time in his life, he was very general. He was definitely closed off emotionally. I think a lot of that was due to, being a guy of his generation and the things that he experienced as a kid. He was the son of migrant workers in California. He was born in like the 1940s. It's like, his view of the world was like totally different from ours. And so in a way, there was this sort of barrier or wall between him and his children that existed.
This, generational wall, right?
Like, right, right.
First generation American, second generation American type of wall.
Exactly, exactly. So yeah, he just grew up with a completely different set of values. I mean, his dad was born in like the 1880s. So if you could imagine a dude like born in Victorian times,
what?
Raising a kid that was born before the end of World War II, and then that guy raising a fucking millennial.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it's horrible.
Where you're like, I'm depressed. And he's like, shut the fuck up.
Get in that trench and shoot that German.
Yeah.
That was sort of the upbringing. And so I think, speaking for myself and my siblings, like we were all sort of really interested in kind of finding out, like both in sort of that morbid curiosity that, anyone who listens to true crime sort of has to figure out what happened. But then there's also this emotional connection of wanting to understand our dad a bit more. And so that's sort of where that kind of drive came from. And I think I'm very much like you, like my desire to sort of like make sense of the messiness of life and the things that happen to us. I think that's it's very trauma informed. But mm-hmm. even as like a little kid, I remember like when I would watch something like 2020, which was a news program that would come on Friday nights, and they'd always every headline was always like something that was going to kill you. It's like, there's an E. coli breakout at Jack in the Box. The pool tubs and kiddie pools like will suck your intestines out if you sit on top of them. Killer bees are moving from Latin America into Texas and on into California. And I remember each time like hearing about this and be like, oh, okay, this thing is going to kill me. So I have to understand everything about it. I have to know, what the threat are. What's the migratory pattern of these bees? How hot do I have to cook the meat to kill the bacteria in it? Whatever it is. And I'm sure to some extent, too, finding out my dad had maybe been considered a participant in this murder. I was like, would my dad kill me for insurance money? mm-hmm. Maybe I should find out some more about this case.
I feel like with that, you're telling us a little bit about what the relationship was with your dad. I mean,
right.
Not only was there a big generational gap, not only was there, a big difference in values, perhaps, but I guess this, you were, it seems like you were afraid of him.
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, my dad was emotionally and physically abusive. I should
have started with that.
that's where the other thing came from. And that's part of it too. And once again, I think that, that was also sort of the result of his experiences. I know that his dad was sort of like a bit of a brutal disciplinarian, and like, the value of that time was just like, oh yeah, you have to hit your kids to make them act right. And I think that's sort of a cultural pattern that's fairly common among that generation. I think things are a lot better now. Like, speaking for my siblings, like all of them have made like efforts to kind of like sort of break away from that cycle. They practice positive parenting. They don't call their kids shit for brains for not knowing the difference between a Phillips head screwdriver and a standard screwdriver. Phillips head is the four-pointed one. The standard is the flathead.
Wow, I wonder why you know that.
I need you to put your hands on your ears and pull your head out of your ass, kid. happy seventh birthday. Those experiences definitely kind of painted a picture of my dad. And essentially once he passed away, which is interestingly was around the time that you and I met, It sort of opened it opened up the family a bit because it allowed us to kind of like talk about this thing, this like sort of big question that we, you know, was sort of impolite for us to discuss with him. But then people were also more open to sharing things as well, because, you know, once the person is dead, it's kind of like, all right, like, I don't have to be concerned with their feelings or whatever anymore.
I mean, worst that can happen is that they haunt me.
You know? Right. Well, yeah, unfortunately, I still dream sometimes. So, you know, they pop in every once in a while to visit. But yeah, so the once my dad passed away, we found that every single time we had a family reunion, we'd all get together. We would just talk about the case. It was always just like, oh, you know, I heard this thing. Like, I saw Calvin. I spoke to him. I found, like, this old brief online. I found this old parole report, whatever it
was.
So
it's almost like all of you guys were dealing with this quietly. Like, you guys were all your own world. All your siblings Yes. were all dealing with this separately without saying it out loud to anyone. And then once your dad passed, it was like, hey, are we all thinking the same thing? Are we all, like, wondering what the fuck this was?
Exactly, exactly. Like, it was just a matter of sort of getting it out into, you know, we can openly discuss this now. Mm-hmm. And so once we sort of had that that restriction kind of taken off of us, it was just like, all right, like what can we find out? And that's the thing of it, too, is at a certain point, you know, the Google searches, like, you know, talking to relatives, whatever it is, it gets you to a certain point. But we still sort of realized that we didn't know the entire story. And so what sort of happened was in 2020, when the pandemic was going on, I actually reached out to Calvin. I had his number. He had been in touch with my older sister. And
was he still in jail?
No. So the interesting, this was another thing too, that sort of drove our curiosity as well, was that, so Calvin was released in 2013. I think just after my dad and my mom had passed away. That's when I got Bruce Wayne.
I love Bruce Wayne versus orphaned.
Yeah, there you
go. I love that more.
It makes me sound rich and handsome, and I am neither. but yeah, so Calvin was, and that sort of raised this other question, because we were like, oh, he's been in there for 30 years. He's never admitted to this crime, and now he's out. And so part of us were kind of wondering, like, oh, did Calvin talk? Did he, you know, provide details, more details on the murder? Like, how is he out all of a sudden? He was there for literally 30 years. But once we found out he was out, it was always this thing of like wanting to talk to him. But then there's this concern that, like, you know, I don't want to re-traumatize this guy who's been in jail for this, this offense for 30 years. This has been his life, basically. You know, the other thing too is like you ask the question and then you get the answer.
And you don't want to know the answer.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And part of you doesn't want it. You know, just like, oh, it's like, yes, your dad and I killed him and we had a fun time doing it. You know, that's
worst case scenario.
Worst case scenario. But at the same time, it's kind of like, well, you know, it's 2020. Calvin is old. You know, people are dying from an illness that, like, targets the elderly, and targets vulnerable populations. Calvin's African American. And so the thinking was like, oh, if I don't get this story from him, if I don't talk to him, he might die before sharing this information.
So it wasn't just about you finally being ready, because maybe you would never have been ready.
Right.
It was like, if I don't do this now, maybe this will be a question in my life forever.
Right, right. Maybe we'll just keep going in circles at these family reunions about, like, oh, what happened in this case? Like, what did they allege that my dad and Calvin did? But that first phone call, I actually made a point of, like, not talking about the case at all. I basically was more interested in kind of finding out like how Calvin even knew my dad, like how they met, like their history. It was kind of like, I don't know if you ever had to do these projects in middle school where you would talk to somebody who was like old.
Yeah, I did. It was what a weird concept.
Right, right, right. But I had to do like three of those reports when I was a kid. And at a certain point, I was just like running out of people over the age of 60 who I'd feel comfortable enough talking to for like for 20 minutes or what have you. I basically just sort of got Calvin's life story and sort of the story of his friendship with my dad more or less up until the murders or the murders, the murder,
the single murder,
the singular murder.
The murder of your childhood is not an actual murder.
Right. Everyone's guilty. So that's sort of, it prompted that first conversation. And from there, it sort of spun out into wanting to do this as sort of a podcast. And there was that concern about like, well, you know, it's kind of a private family matter. And this is something that was discussed with the siblings as well, because everyone wanted to get more information and to sort of, you know, figure out like kind of like what happened and get to the bottom of things. And there was concern on one sibling in particular, who I won't name, who's very much like, yeah, I'm you know, super curious about this stuff, and I want to know the answers too. I'm just worried about it being out in public for everyone. And that was, you know, sort of the contrast. But like, on the other hand, my thinking is like, well, like, you know, my father was publicly prosecuted for murder. Like, he was accused of this crime. And like, this is sort of the like the thing that our family has just kind of carried and has been a part of our upbringing, our existence for my entire childhood. I had no idea about it. And so to the extent that it gets attention on that or whatever, it's just like, you know, the chicken's burnt, you know, mm-hmm. it's cooked. Like, you know, whatever happened, everything else. The only thing that we're bringing up now is maybe how we feel about it. And, you know, I'd rather have that and have other people be aware of that than to not know. Because that was the other part of it, too, is the exchange is, you know, if I was Bruce Wayne, I probably would have paid someone to, like, go out, conduct this entire investigation, you know, write everything into a report, give it to me in a little black dossier, and I could read it. And
you can,
like,
read, you know, it in your enormous mansion by yourself, my mansion, being more
exactly.
sad. Yeah.
Exactly, without having to share it with anyone. But the thing is, like, I got law school debt. I write for a cartoon show.
Which is another part I wanted to ask about, which is, you know, before, when I met you, we were obviously in the world of comedy in New York. I didn't meet you because you were my lawyer, but at that moment you were an attorney, and you were an attorney right up until maybe a year into us working at Disney. You were working two jobs, so, you know, I think you were born to write comedy and to write for TV. Why? I mean, did the fact that your family had like a question mark of murder in your life like influence you being like making the decision to go to law school and effectively become a lawyer?
Right. I mean, like, it's funny because I do get this question a lot. And when I reflect on it, it's kind of like the murder itself. Like, it was this big shaping force in our lives. Like, it dictated dictated a lot of our interactions with our dad, with like the way we sort of perceived adults in our family. It definitely sort of influenced like his career and like what sort of happened to him. And I think to that extent, it did have that effect. Now, I don't think it was a conscious thing, because I think for me, like when I found out about it, I was sort of like a teenager, and it wasn't like it sort of prompted me to be like, oh, I want to find out about the justice system and mm-hmm. like, you know, how this thing could happen to people or whatever it was. I think the sort of like backdoor sneaky way that it came up is that like it made my family very financially insecure, because like my dad, like his career never really recovered. He'd been in politics at the time of the murder, or the time of the trial, and it had sort of like thrown him off of that course in his life. And then after that, he sort of did like some freelance consulting stuff and like that sort of thing, but never really earned like a real income as long as I knew him. And so growing up, I was just like, oh, okay, like, you know, my family is like middle class, sort of like barely hanging on, my mom's supporting the kids. Like, it's probably really important for me to have a stable job and a profession. And like a lot of other kids coming out of the United States at that time, was like, yeah, professional school, that's the way. That'll lead me to happiness and riches and a, you know, 3,000 square foot wife or whatever.
3,000 square foot wife.
You know what I mean?
Yes, I know exactly what you mean. Surprisingly, I do.
There we go. So I think that's sort of, you know, those like small, like kind of like background, you know, influential factors are what pushed me to that. Like, I don't necessarily know that, you know, I think if I had known more, if I'd been more aware of what had happened, like I probably wouldn't have picked this, that profession, law, because, you know, the experience of creating this podcast, of sort of reading through the trial and, coming to understand the charges and the way that the authorities kind of investigated the case actually made me very, very disenchanted with the legal system. And interestingly enough, like once I finished the, I've been a member of three state bars in my time. And the first one that I took was for the California State Bar exam. I took that, I passed, and I became a member like right out of law school. And you know, for years I'd been an active member because I never actually practiced there. And then I sort of stopped paying my dues. And then after I finished this podcast, I was kind of like, I want nothing to do with this fucking with this profession anymore. So I actually resigned. I wrote a letter, a motion to the state Supreme Court of California saying, please let me resign my bar membership. I never intend to practice in California.
Are you serious?
I'm serious. And so they sent me a little letter that says, all right, you've officially resigned.
Is a part of it California. Because in the podcast you find some perhaps proof that, the justice system is unfair?
Oh, I mean, like, I think that's just kind of, perhaps. that's an excellent, you would make a great attorney. That's an
I
insult.
I wonder.
May it be. No, for sure. I mean, like, yeah, there were lots of little discoveries and revelations along the way. Even talking to my aunt on my mom's side, who is an attorney, she said, like, yeah, you could indict a ham sandwich, like, legally, you could you could charge really? A ham sandwich. I mean, like, eventually it would be thrown out.
I thought his name was Steve Bannon.
Oh, snap. Look at that. Wow.
That's an old reference.
You got to get that, reference. You got to get that in your 2016 Colbert packet. My God.
How did you know it was actually in the 2016? I don't think it was Colbert. I think it was another packet. Guys, packets are basically scripts you send to shows so that they hire you. And that is a joke I wrote in 2016 that I brought back.
Yes. Of course. And the funny thing is, like, some version of that joke probably played on five different late night shows at some point in time.
Wow. Thanks, Alex. I guess I'm not an original thinker.
No, I'm not. That's an insult against them, not you. Oh my gosh. They're still running that stuff. They would be if they could. But yeah, so like, yeah, it was definitely very disenchanting. And like, there are lots, you kind of go into the profession sort of understanding, like any other profession, there are flaws, like there are oversights. Like there are injustices and like, but everyone's there, like, trying to do the job, trying to make it a better system, like, trying to get the gears of equity and justice, finely tuned. And, this experience showed me that they're not like the same problems that we ran into back in the 1980s or basically the same ones we encountered in the 1960s and the 1940s. They've been going on since before this country was a country. And to some extent, they continue to exist and persist today. And it turns out that not a damn thing a public servant has done about it has made any difference.
It's so funny because when I moved from Venezuela to the States and when I, when I was a juror for the first time in my life, coming from an autocratic country where it's not a jury system, it's a judge system, and the judges are like appointed by, like a dictatorial government. Like, my uncle was, my two uncles were put in jail for, one of them was a journalist and they called him a terrorist. And then my other uncle was in a business with a guy that had involvement in the government. And they were like, oh, we just want the full business. So we're just going to put him in jail. So, coming from that system, when I came here, I had a very, I'd say, romanticized fairy tale. And also as I told you, I've watched true crime my whole life, Forensic Files. I was like, oh my God, I love CSI and I love lawyers. You know what I mean? Like, that's a country where justice fully functions. But obviously throughout the course of my life here in the States, that's obviously been proven false. Every system is a bit broken, and some people are victim to a broken system more than others. And then, and you have people that get away with murder if they have money. You felt it firsthand. I think a lot of people feel it tangentially, or because they have to be jurors in something and they don't want to. But I do find it really interesting that it wasn't, like, I feel like that's a symbolic move for you to write to the Supreme Court of California and be like, I don't want any part of this. Because you could have just not paid your dues, right?
Right, right. And that's what I was doing, more or less. And they're like, well, you can't practice if you're not paying. I'm like, yeah, I've never practiced in California. Like, you know, I got this license almost by accident. So, yeah. So I could have just sort of, you know, continued doing it. But at a certain point, I was kind of like, you know, I don't want to really be a part of this, like, you know, to draw a living from it, whatever it was, like, you know. And because in the beginning too, like, when I went into law, I never imagined myself working at like a big law firm or doing you know, high stakes M&A or corporate litigation or what have you. Like, I was happy to be sort of a, like, a little county or city attorney or what have you. And that's kind of what I did. When I met you, I was working as a litigator for the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey. And then when I left to come to our show on Disney, I was working for the New York City Department of Education. You know, and these are sort of like, you know, the public, you know, public service oriented jobs. Like, you know, we're out there sort of like, you know, fighting for the people of New York, you know, fighting for the children of New York City, you know, to ensure that they have a safe and a healthy learning environment and everything else. And yeah, and like the same, you know, the same issues keep coming up everywhere. And yeah, and it was very sort of, it was very frustrating in a way. And so at a certain point, it's kind of like, well, I think I'm going to do more good writing a show about a talking hamster than I am busting a principal who's stealing time or whatever. Yeah.
Oh, that's what you were doing, busting, like, you just come in and like, stop right there. Eating a two-hour lunch instead of a one-hour lunch.
There we go.
Stealing 1 hour of taxpayer money here, baby.
That's right. We're gonna spend 1,000 times the amount of the thing that you stole to, you know, put this down in a report and have nothing happen.
Exactly. I think this is a show. I think this is a pilot waiting to be written. It's low-stakes crime fighting.
That's right. We can call it... God, I'm trying to think of a horrible pun title. Teacher's Pet.
Teacher's Pet.
Teacher's Pet.
Teacher's Pet. Teacher's Pact. You know what? We're off the clock here. Disney's not paying us for this.
That's
hour.
Right.
I have to say that I do feel a little guilty, because as you were doing this podcast, you know, you were working two jobs and you were doing this podcast and you were rehashing a lot of this trauma and you were sort of having to deal with maybe dormant feelings that you weren't realized you felt. And selfishly, when you told me about your dad and all this, since I was a true crime fanatic, I said, you should do a podcast. And then I saw you suffer for 2 years.
That's true. And for the record, Joa is I like to call it a secret producer on my podcast. You know, she sort of put me in touch with the person who eventually helped make this a thing. So she is the architect of my torment.
Architect of your torment.
That's right.
I love that. You know, on my tombstone. Architect of torment.
There we go. I like that. Yeah, we'll get that done next year. Sure.
Yeah, because I'm here for a good time, not a long time, baby.
I love it. Yeah. No. So, like, you know, I've said it before and I say it again, like, this is not necessarily an experience I would want to recreate, but I am happy that I did it. And I do thank you for giving me some of the impetus. I don't thank you.
No, thank me.
My feelings aren't valid.
Don't be nice, Alex. Come on. That's not what our relationship is based on.
It's not based on nice. You know, I feel both gratitude and resentment.
That's perfect. I'm basically your parent.
That's it. More or less.
So you're you're a moderately funny person.
Oh God.
I've thought about a lot about this as in the past few years in particular, as I'm no longer a youth. I feel like I'm approaching middle age slowly but surely, faster but surely.
Surely.
For me, humor is just it almost feels like I could not survive life without it. Like, I don't know how people go through life without humor being maybe not the first reaction, because the first reaction is usually not, let's laugh at this. But like,
it's
the
fear.
Close second.
Yes.
The
yes.
Close second reaction to everything in my life is like, how do I make a joke out of this? Because it gives levity to things. And so I always say that, like, the funniest people are also the ones that feel everything else the most, because that's sort of how it works. Do you think that the fact that you, and you have a very particular sense of humor, Alex, I'd say your humor is very, it can get very dark and very funny, but also very, like, complicated. And you can, like, some of your jokes are so out of, like, they come out of nowhere and they shock. Do you think your humor comes out of some of this? And are other people in your family finding, like, use humor in this way? Or are you the weird comical relief in the romantic comedy that is your life?
I think that is the case. For me, I found that it was very difficult to connect with other kids and with other people. You know, just because of sort of my background, the way I was raised, the way I interact with other people, I think it's very, very different. As I said, you know, father, violent Mexican, raised by a Victorian violent Mexican. So it, you know, produces, you know, it's weird. I often joke to people that, like, you know, you've heard of elder millennials. I'm like an eldritch millennial. It's like I exist in a completely different, you know, plane of understanding. Like, my references are all, like, you know, 50 years out of date, like... It's strange. It's very strange. And so for me, it was very difficult to connect with other kids on, like, oh, common interests or what have you. And so humor was kind of the way that I would make friends, and that I would make, like, a connection with someone else. And I think in our family, like, you know, I think we're all, like, pretty funny, but I was the only one that was kind of, like, actively working at, like, you know, not necessarily, like, performing necessarily, but, you know, that I would use humor in a way that was sort of different from my siblings. Like, you know, we would always, like, you know, kind of bag on each other and, like, make jokes and insults and, like, everything else. But I was sort of the one always looking to, like, you know, escalate it to, like, you know, get the prank or the whatever it was, the revenge to, like, you know, a high, like, ridiculous point. I'll tell this little story right here. So when I was a kid, did you ever do a Valentine's Day at your school? And then everyone would have to give everyone else, like, candy and that kind of thing.
Oh yeah. You mean one of the most traumatic days of my childhood? Absolutely.
I've opened a door. yes. So yeah. Well, and here's an example of a way that I kind of did that. And so what happened was, so I remember I had this friend in one of my classes who, you know, every once in a while we'd have, like, a disagreement or something. And then I remember we got into a fight on, like, around Valentine's Day. And so what I did was, you know, I had a bag of candy that had, like, 30 pieces in it. There were 30 kids in the class, and, like, everyone would get one. And so I started giving candy out. But what I did was, the morning, I took two bags of candy out of it. And so I started giving, you know, the one piece of candy to, like, every kid or whatever. I'm going in order. And then I get to my friend and then myself, because, you know, you start, like, you know, it's a Montessori school. So there's, like, a system of equity where you go around and start and everything else. And so I orchestrated it so that she didn't get any candy and then I didn't get any candy. And so, you know, she starts crying. You know, we're elementary school students. So she starts crying that I didn't do it. And I was just like, you know, why would I do it to you? Like, I didn't even get myself candy. It was a complete accident.
Wait, is this humor or manipulation?
Oh, God. I don't think I know the difference. Therein lies the joke. But it's just, like, it's just sort of like that. That's the kind of thinking that I would sort of engage in. I'm what I'm doing is painting a picture of myself as a young man, so you can sort of understand, like, the level of thought that would have to go in for a child to be like, on that morning, I'm angry at my friend, so I'm going to humiliate her by not giving her any candy, and then I'm also going to throw blame off of myself by not giving myself any candy, because why wouldn't a kid want candy on Valentine's Day?
I think you could have been a criminal and then you decided to do a hard pivot into being a lawyer, and then another hard pivot into being a comedy writer.
That's
right.
Here we are. So yeah, so that, like, that it's all, I mean, like, I guess the other part of it too is, I think a lot of it is sort of, like, trauma based, you know, just in terms of, like, oh, you know, it's a coping mechanism. It's, you know, trying to find, like, the best situation. It's finding a way to sort of survive with, like, you know, the weird, brutal reality of being on this terrible planet, which, as I mentioned, is a kind of a drag sometimes.
Were you Were you able to find humor while making this insane podcast?
A little bit, yeah, for sure. I mean, like, one of my big bummers is that there are, you know, there are lots of things that we recorded and, you know, things that I wanted to sort of inject that are sort of more in my voice in terms of just having like that kind of weird gallows humor. And, you know, the podcast, I think, is well done. I don't think it's like 100% a reflection of the, you know, like kind of like, you know, my humor and like my, you know, my sensibilities in it. You know, because we're dealing with, like, you know, a guy who was incarcerated and torn away from his family for 30 years. We're dealing with a terrible murder that has basically been unsolved, more or less, the way that it was prosecuted. And so, so to some extent, it was kind of like, you know, we wanted to give the audience sort of like the best chance for like grasping onto the material. I would have injected more humor into it, of course, but, you know, it might have been difficult to find someone willing to laugh along with such terrible circumstances.
Yeah. As someone who's listened to it, I'm like, I feel like I saw another side of you, because both of us, we really do encapsulate our trauma and our sadness with like a lot of humor.
Yeah.
And like the saddest moments are always just dripping with sarcasm. And, you know, I also think that's not that healthy sometimes. sometimes you can just be like sad or observant or tell a story. So that was like, I did appreciate listening to like a serious Alex Estrada, almost more like the attorney versus the comedy writer.
Right.
So I really did appreciate it. And I also felt like it tells a story through your perspective. And it also, it does a good job of building the case through different perspectives. So it isn't just a murder happened, someone died, then there was an investigation. It almost feels like a diary.
Yeah.
And it feels more human. And now I'm having trouble listening to like my regular crime podcasts. Because I'm like, of course there's like people that, not only the people that are affected, it's like the family, the friends, the people, you know, the friends and family of the people that are now incarcerated. Like, this is, I don't know. I don't like to say that I see this type of quote unquote, and look at the word I'm going to use, entertainment. Mm-hmm. You know, using it. It's so weird that humanity is using like the darkest moments of some people as entertainment. But I also feel like as comedians, we are very unafraid of the darkest moments because they are so fertile for reaction and perspective.
Yeah.
I don't think we shy away from it.
Right, right. 100%. Yeah, I think the like part of the thing that true crime gets away with is it's sort of like it portray it's, you know, as we were talking earlier about creating order out of chaos. The thing that we don't always get is sort of understanding like the full consequences, mm-hmm. You know, not only of the crimes themselves, but also, you know, the reactions, the aftermath of the crime. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that, that's often ignored in true crime, and something that I sort of, strove to like bring into the light a bit with my family's own experience. Just because the, you know, the consequences like have been written on our lives, on right. everybody. It colored our relationship with our dad, you know, certainly colored, you know, the way that he interacted with Calvin and with, you know, with city authorities and stuff for the rest of his life. And of course, you know, that will translate down on to our descendants, you know, to like my nieces and nephews and their families and stuff, because of, you know, of this terrible thing that happened back in the 1970s. It ripples across. And you know, that's just a family of a guy who was accused of this crime,
right.
Not even convicted. Like, you know, if you start thinking about Calvin and his children, about Tony Virgilio, the man who was killed, and like his family, like it's like the podcast is full of that.
Mm-hmm.
And as comedians, especially, it's sort of like, yeah, I think we often sort of try to like, you know, like part of the fun is sort of untangling like, oh, like the hypotheticals, like, you know, the ridiculousness, kind of highlighting consequence in a way. Like, you know, I remember some of my like the discussions we used to have, like at the Pit and thereafter, like, you know, I used to perform with a sketch comedy group, and we did a lot of stuff that was sort of focused on what I would call, I won't call it risque, that feels like you we're walking around in negligees. That's fun. It's not my thing. But, you know, we would deal, like you said, with like sort of these hard, complicated concepts, and there was always this fear that, like, oh, are we going to get the audience to turn on us because we're taking this premise too far, or, like, you know, we're going to present this in the right way. And, you know, my thinking was always just like, you know, there are certain categories of things that we talk about, that we joke about. We joke about, like, you know, trauma or race or what have you. It's like you're handling nuclear material in a way. Mm. But part of the fun, I think, is kind of figuring out, like, how do we safely sort of juggle that? Mm-hmm. you know, because if you're successful, you're a guy juggling like an atomic bomb, basically. Like, you know, it's sort of exciting, dangerous, if they can pull this off, whatever. And if you drop it, everybody dies.
Well, that's really, you know, that's what we do. We have people's lives in our hands,
right,
as
right,
we
right.
juggle.
Well, I'm just saying, like, you know, that, you know, you've done shows, I've done shows, like, you know, there have been, you know, and the most exciting acts to watch, and I think the ones that everyone emulates, and the types of performances that really make you want to get into comedy are watching people sort of, you know, getting up there and kind of nailing these subjects, these difficult to talk about, difficult, like, you know, people talk about, like, horrible things that have happened in their own lives, you know, terrible things that have occurred to them, like, what have you. You know, the captivating performances are the ones that sort of take those experiences and manage to kind of pull off, like, you know, what's basically like acrobatics in a way. The thing that sucks about comedy is when you see people who go up and try to do that, who are either inept or inexperienced or what have you, and then they, you know, they fucking die. They die on stage, and the audience and the show is. And the show dies with them.
Yeah.
It's
really interesting that you say this, because one of the things that has happened, and like a phenomenon, a joke phenomenon that has happened that I've been following and that I find super interesting, is that Venezuela is a country, for example, that is very, it leans on humor a lot. And it's not a coincidence, because it, you know, there's a lot of trauma, there's a lot of tragedy. And basically, there's this article, I believe it was in The Economist or in The Atlantic, where they charted the jokes that were being said by Venezuelans, particularly in, like, from 2016 to 2018, which is right when, you know, there was a huge economic crisis and people weren't able to find food and this. And a lot of the jokes that were used there were the same jokes, perhaps changed like a 10% from jokes in countries that had been occupied by communism, and almost identical. And it, you know, what the article questions is, did the jokes sort of surge out of nowhere? Did they, or was there some influence? But either way, these two places that suffered very similar things were able to create jokes so similar to each other that then represented their tragedy. And that jokes are sort of necessary as a way to deal with when you're surrounded by despair and chaos. And I don't think it's a coincidence that us in a miniature scale, you know, we tend to gravitate towards people that do the same. Like, I recently hung out with someone who I like to call her kind of like a downer. I really care for her, but every time I hang out with her, it's like even the least traumatizing thing in the world, it just feels like a heavy burden. And I understand that. I understand that life is a heavy burden. But sometimes when you're carrying that heavy burden, like, sometimes it's just funny to be like, my back's gonna break with this burden on my back, right? Like, it just, it creates levity, and a necessary levity. And I do think it's admirable when people come out of bad situations and find ways to make the world around them more light.
Yeah.
And I think you're one of those you know, dumbasses. So yeah, I can't be nice to you.
You can't. You really can't. My God.
I was about to be nice, and then I just pulled it back.
You're about to hit that point. Yeah, I mean, I guess, like, you know, that's some, you know, I don't really have, like, life mottos or whatever. Like, you know, there are no posters on my wall, as you can see. You know, I don't attribute a lot to, like, you know, quotes or whatever it is. But, you know, I guess a mantra that comes to mind is kind of this idea of like, well, if I can laugh at it, then I can live with it. You know, if this terrible thing that's gone on, that's, you know, happened to my family, like, you know, here's an example of a, you know, a thing, because at my my mother's funeral, like, we were all, you know, it was 6 months after my dad had passed away. It was kind of like, you know, it was a huge loss. My mother was wonderful. Like, you know, whatever the complicated as my relationship with my dad was, my mother was like the exact opposite of that. Like, mm-hmm. you know, the relationship was so, so pure and clear, that I felt nothing except for, like, true grief. Mm-hmm. And I remember sitting with my siblings, we were just talking about, like, you know, what a drain the last 9 months had been. You know, and I have, there are 7 kids, I have 6 siblings. And, you know, we're just talking about, like, how sad the funeral was. And, we're just letting it sit in. And then I let a moment pass and I said, yeah, I'm like, you know what's really sad? One of us is going to have to go through this 6 more times.
It's true.
Yeah.
It's funny because
yeah.
It's true.
It's true. It's true.
And the timing of it, perfection. Did they laugh?
No. It bombed.
That was a time when you were juggling,
I dropped the nuclear device. I'm sorry. Chernobyled.
You were Chernobyled, but you know what? You came out stronger because of it, I guess. I don't think that's what happened in Chernobyl, but
yeah,
you know. Well, Alex, thank you so much for talking to me. Very rarely, I think, are people able to hear, you know, the hosts and, you know, second tier victims of true crime and true crime podcasts, you know, come and make jokes on another podcast.
Of course.
So can you remind the audience the name of the podcast, where to find it, and where to follow you?
Yes, of course. The podcast is called The Estate, which is produced in conjunction with Sonoro Media and Tenderfoot TV. You can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can find me on Instagram at AlexEstradaNYC or on Twitter at AlexTheStrada.com or AlexTheStrada.
Wow, almost nailed it.
And my personal website is Alex-Estrada.com.
Wow, how many times have you done that?
Just this once.
Oh my God. You know what I forgot to bring up? Do you know what I forgot to bring up? How everyone assumes that I don't speak Spanish. And then everyone assumes Alex Estrada and the way that you look that you speak Spanish. And you have the worst Spanish I've ever heard in my entire life.
Oh my God. I remember trying to, yeah, like some of those scripts we got for Flama. And yeah, just like my pronunciation's all off. It's really bad. It's really bad. Like, I got to do something about it. But
I think you're the whitest Mexican I've ever met.
There we go.
On the inside. On the inside.
Yeah, on the outside, I should be mowing your lawn.
You made that joke. I didn't.
I did make that joke. I did make the joke. I have mowed lawns. It's hard work. I have respect for anyone who does it.
Okay, we need to get back to work, actually.
All right.
We have several scripts to read.
Oh, God. Yeah, it's... Oh, jeez. Okay.
All right.
Very good.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.